may seem strange on a day when important elections are taking place in Greece and in France and in Egypt, and perhaps elsewhere, who knows. It may seem strange discussing an unfinished essay by Frederick Engels, which wasn't even published in his lifetime. But I think the importance of discussing this essay and Marxist theory in general is that no political tendency can expect to make serious progress without a thorough grounding in political theory, without a thorough understanding of the theoretical ideas of scientific socialism. Now, Frederick Engels, of course, was a close collaborator of Karl Marx, and together, or to be more precise, independently, Engels and Marx came to the same philosophical views. And on realizing that, on beginning their collaboration, they collaborated closely, politically, for the rest of their lives. But it was Engels, probably more than Marx, who developed and retained an interest in science and scientific developments. And Engels' own views on this are in his book Anti-During, and more specifically in Dialectics of Nature, which wasn't written as a book, but was really a collection of articles and essays that Engels wrote during his lifetime. Now, the fundamental ideas of Marx and Engels, perhaps we need to begin with, are based upon the ideas of dialectical materialism. That is to say, they saw the whole of, not just society, but the whole of reality, the whole of the universe, as being based upon material existence. There was a uniformity to the universe, a material uniformity, that allowed for the existence of nothing else beyond that. There was no spiritual realm. There's no celestial pilot light in our heads. There's no other realm other than the material universe. And everything that develops, all the processes within society, within nature, are based upon material processes and material laws, which again are all interconnected with each other. At the same time, they put forward the idea, they drew from Hegel, the idea of dialectics, that is to say, constant change and constant movement through contradiction. And dialectics, you could say, in a nutshell, is really the logic or the philosophy of change through contradiction. Now, this is not a discussion on dialectical material as such, but nevertheless, that's the important foundation upon which Marx and Engels developed their ideas. Now, particularly, they applied their ideas to the developments taking place within society and within politics and economics. And they always laid stress on the fact that it was fundamentally material processes that developed and that were the drivers of history and the drivers of social change, rather than the realm of ideas, the realm of the intellect, if you like, the realm of political ideas, of religious ideas, and so on. Not that political ideas weren't important, because they often pointed out that political ideas that had a material base behind it, the political ideas were almost a material force themselves, but only provided the material conditions existed. And they described how all social change, all important historical changes from one epoch to another, were really driven by material processes, by changes taking place in the productivity. That is to say, the way in which humankind interacted with nature in producing the necessities of life. And those things dictated the fundamental laws and the fundamental conditions of the production of within society. They dictated the class relations in society, and that in turn dictated the legal form, if you like, and the laws within society, which also dictated other things and had an effect on science and had an effect on literature and art and religion and so on. And they always pointed out the enormous fundamental significance of material development in driving society forward. Now, it was in the context of that kind of discussion that Engels put forward this idea, the ideas he put forward in his pamphlet, The Part Played by Labour in the Transition from Ape to Man. In the context in which Engels wrote that essay, or began to write the essay, because it was never finished, is really the discussion about human evolution, which was taking place at that particular time. Charles Darwin's book on the Descent of Man was published about 5 years before Engels started his pamphlet. And if you read Charles Darwin's book and read Engels' pamphlet, there isn't a shadow of doubt in my mind that Engels read Charles Darwin's book on the Descent of Man. There are even phrases, odd phrases and odd little ideas, little cameo ideas, which pop up in Engels' essay, which are almost drawn directly from Charles Darwin. So that was the context in which Engels was actually writing. But a lot of the discussion about human development, although there was an acknowledgement after Darwin, Darwin wrote his original book on the Origin of Species some 12 or 13 years earlier. And by the time The Descent of Man was published, there was a general acknowledgement, at least among the more advanced thinking sections of society, that human evolution was a fact, that there had been evolution. But nevertheless, it was often discussed within the framework of what you might call an idealized view. That is to say, those idealistic historians who saw intellect as the main driver of historical change, you also, if you like, transferred the same idea to human development. And they saw the development of humankind, the development from apes to man, as something that was driven by intellectual development, almost as if human beings had somehow acquired a greater intelligence, a larger brain capacity, and that had driven the evolution of the hand, which is unique to human beings, of bipedalism, of an upright stance and so on, almost as if intellectual development itself actually drove those evolutionary movements. And the whole of progress of human society was progress towards a higher state of mind. And even in Darwin, even in Darwin's book, The Descent of Man, although Darwin acknowledges the importance of bipedalism, he acknowledges the importance of the human hand. But even in Darwin, you can see a kind of a muddled kind of thinking about what was actually driving human development. And there's a little quote in Darwin which shows this. He actually says, the mental powers of some early progenitor of man must have been more highly developed than in any existing ape before even the most imperfect form of speech could come into use. So you can see that even in Darwin, Darwin kind of harboured this idea that intellectual development itself was driving the evolution of human society. What was Engels' view? What was it that Engels put forward in his little essay? Engels turned the discussion on its head. Engels said that apes began to lose the habit of using their hands to walk and adopted a more and more erect posture. Apes adopted an erect posture, this is what Engels said. This was the decisive step in the transition from ape to man. So the decisive step, he argued, was bipedalism, the upright stance. This is what Engels argued. Erect gait among our hairy ancestors became first the rule and then in time a necessity. Other diverse functions must then in the meantime have evolved upon the hands. So you can see the logic of Engels' argument. An upright stance meant focus on the hands and the development of the hands. The decisive step had been taken. The hands had become free and could henceforth attain ever greater dexterity. The greater flexibility thus acquired was inherited and increased from generation to generation. And again, I won't go into it, but Engels talks about the development of the tendons and the muscles and the bones of the hand and so on to achieve that kind of dexterity. And then he says, and this is really the key to the pamphlet and even the title of the pamphlet, thus the hand is not only the organ of labour, it is also the product of labour. Only by labour, by adaptation to ever new operations, through the inheritance of muscles, ligaments, and over long periods of time, bones that had undergone special development, and the ever-renewed employment of this inherited fitness in new and more complicated operations, have given the human hand a high degree of perfection. Now notice, at this point, Engels hasn't talked about the development of the brain and the development of the intellect. And what Engels is suggesting is that the fundamental step in the development from ape to man is that interaction between man and nature, what he calls labour. What he means labour is the conscious interaction between an ape, which is upright with hands, the conscious interaction, conscious labour, between that upright ape and nature, using nature, processing nature, creating within nature means and developments for its own that would benefit its own procreation. And that was actually quite a revolutionary idea. That's what Engels meant in the part played by labour in the transition from ape to man. Now, I haven't got time to talk in vast detail about the modern scientific view of human development. I've actually given out a table. I hope you don't spend too much time looking at it when you should be listening to me. But you can look at it later, and I've highlighted key parts of that, and it kind of summarises. I've taken most of it from a short book published by the Natural History Museum. It kind of summarises human development. But the important point is that all of modern archaeological thinking is now exactly in line with the ideas put forward by Engels 140 years ago. Now it's almost accepted as a given. I say almost, it's 100% accepted as a given that around sometime between 3 and 6 million years ago, that a certain evolutionary branch of apes in Africa developed bipedalism alongside their fellows, if you like, alongside their cousins who stayed in the trees, or who stayed semi-bipedal, like modern-day chimps. It's now accepted that bipedalism may have gone back as far as 4, 5, or 6 million years ago. And the significant thing is that those bipedal apes were not in any sense cultured or intellectually developed or intelligent like modern human beings. They were upright apes in terms of their brain capacities. They were upright apes, and the most important of these is are the Australopithecines. The Australopithecus is a fancy word that means southern ape, and a whole genus of early hominids were given that particular name. And one in particular was discovered about 3 million years ago in East Africa. And that was found that was found extensively. Since the first find, I think in the mid-1980s, many, many more versions of this particular fossil have been found. It was nicknamed Lucy because the archaeologist who discovered it at the time was listening to a Beatles record, which had that famous line, "Lucy in the sky with diamonds." That's why this fossil was named Lucy. But the Lucy fossil, Australopithecus afarensis, to give it its proper name, the Lucy fossil was, if you like, the first in an important line of development that showed an upright ape with effectively a chimp's brain, a chimpanzee's brain capacity, an upright ape with the beginnings of a human hand. Not quite a human hand, but the beginnings of a human hand. In other words, it shows the capacity at that time for focus on the hands, for focus on work, and focus on a conscious interaction with nature. Now, coincidentally, it's shortly after this time that also the first tools were discovered. It's quite possible that there were tools earlier than that, but the earlier tools wouldn't have been preserved because tools that are made of wood, for instance, or hide or bone are very often not preserved, whereas stone tools are preserved. But the first stone tools are coincidental with this particular development. And to quote a man called Leslie Aiello from the Department of Anthropology at UCL, committed bipedalism, in other words, more or less bipedalism fixed within that genus, committed bipedalism has the obvious effect of freeing the forelimb from locomotive function. Dedicated use of the forelimb for object manipulation would be expected to be associated with enhanced hand-eye coordination and associated increase in neural circuitry, speed and coordination of arm movements and hammering, throwing, and presumably tool manufacture would require increased neural capacity and integration. Now that's modern, a modern style of writing, but it's almost identical to what was written by Engels 140 years earlier. What this anthropologist is saying is that the upright stance and the ability to manipulate in the hands in and of itself began the development of improved neural circuitry, in other words, the development of the brain. And that was the beginning of the increase in brain capacity. So you had the conscious, for the first time, the conscious creation of tools and tools to make other tools, which is an important, significant development. A lot of modern apes use tools, but they don't use tools to make other tools. But what's important is that the development of tools and the development of tools to make tools necessarily involves the development of culture. It necessarily involves the development of other aspects of culture. Now, it's impossible to separate out all of the different aspects of the development of culture. It's impossible to separate them out because they're all integrated one with another. It's impossible to begin the development of tools consistently within a genus without also the development of some thought processes, some enhanced thought processes, the ability to think abstractly, the ability to begin to intellectualize in a way that wasn't necessary when you didn't use tools. In order to make tools, to find particular rocks, to develop particular shape, to have the foresight to know what you want to do with a particular rock, necessarily means the development of an intellectual capacity. And that necessarily means also the development of language, because communication must necessarily mean communication about particular rocks and the site where rocks are found and the shape of the rocks that are required and so on. So the development of language, the development of tool use, the development of communication, the development, in other words, of culture, all of these things necessarily go hand in hand. So the upright stance, the fact that there's a hand, the beginning of interaction with nature, the labour, in other words, necessarily launched humankind on that path towards the growth of cognitive ability, communication, and language. Again, to quote Engels, this is what Engels said. The development of labour necessarily helped to bring the members of society closer together by increasing cases of mutual support and joint activity, and by making clear the advantage of this joint activity to each individual. In short, men in the making arrived at the point where they had something to say to each other. Necessity created the organ. The undeveloped larynx of the ape was slowly but surely transformed. And again, that's been absolutely vindicated by all modern scientific understanding. To quote Stephen Mithen from the Department of Archaeology in the University of Reading, I thought again this could come directly out of Engels. He says, in relation to modern human foragers, modern tribes, particularly in Southwest Africa, who forage for the livelihood, the interaction with the natural world, their interaction with the natural world, the production, the form and the use of tools, the building and the placement of hearths and huts are as much social as non-social behaviour. Human social behaviour is deeply embedded and indeed is created by all activities. The pervasiveness of social behaviour is true in all domains of human activity. In other words, unlike modern chimps, who do use tools occasionally, who can make an odd tool here and there, you have what in effect is a social use of tools. The use of tools by early human beings wasn't an individual thing, wasn't a thing, if you like, an opportunist copying from someone else or an incidental thing, but it was a social thing. Human interaction, the making of tools, the use of tools was a social thing. So what we have then is the development of culture. And all of these developments themselves necessarily confer an evolutionary advantage to those apes that actually have those features, because it necessarily means that you have a wider range of habitats. It means that you have a great ability to gather and to harbour and to look after resources. You have the ability to make a wider range of tools and artifacts and so on. And all of this becomes part of an accumulated social knowledge, an accumulated social wealth, if you like, a reservoir of wealth. So more and more, the advantage that is gained by labour, by the development of intellect, more and more it is embodied within the culture, within the genus as a whole, within society as a whole, if you want to call it primitive society as a whole, rather than simply in the animal itself. Again, to quote Stephen Mithen from the University of Reading Department of Archaeology, for modern humans, all material culture is actively used in social interaction. By modern humans, he doesn't mean 2012, he means Homo sapiens from 300,000 years ago. And he said, among primates in general, there appears to be a correlation between brain size, as measured by the neocortex ratio, and group size, which is a measure of social complexity. In other words, he actually says that there seems to be a correlation between how strong and healthy the group is, the culture is, and the actual brain size itself. And if you think about it, even the physical development of the brain, the physical growth of the brain, the development of neural capacities that are linked to speech, that are linked to language, that are linked to intellectual activities generally, the development of the brain is impossible physically without a culture within which it can actually develop. If you look at the fossil remains of the pelvis, for instance, going back a million or a million and a half years, you can see quite clearly that, as it is with modern humans, you could see that the females could not possibly have given birth to infants with fully developed brains. It's a fact that in human procreation, human children are born physically immature. That is to say, the brains are not fully developed. Otherwise, it would be impossible for the mothers to give birth to them, because the human brain is only developed, I think, to about 25% of its proper size at the time of birth. Now, if you imagine that an infant has to be then born and then nurtured, so the physical size of its brain is developing, let alone the size of the body in general, then obviously that can only take place in a society in which there's cultural and nurturing of infants and teaching of infants and so on. So again, the development of culture, the development of the interaction, communication and language, the development of culture generally, became an essential part of the physical development of the brain, because it was impossible for, once you get a brain of a certain size, it's impossible for that brain to be born through by a normal means, by any other way. Incidentally, it's worth making the point that the brain didn't develop gradually, smoothly and evenly. There's an interesting graph I've got here. I didn't produce it, but this is an interesting graph done by an American anthropologist. And what she did was she measured the brain capacity of literally hundreds and hundreds of skulls of ancient hominids going right back to several million years. And she notes that there are particular surges represented by these lines, when there was rapid development of the brain. And the most important development, and the most important period for the development of brain size and brain capacity, didn't come recently. In fact, in recent human development, brain size has become really less important. the Neanderthals had brains as big as ours, or possibly even bigger than ours. And brain size has become less important. But the biggest jumps took place very early on in human development. I'll come in a moment to perhaps suggest a reason why that's happened. But the development of the human brain came rapidly very early on. And I would suggest that the reason why it tails off is because in the later stages of human development, it's not that there isn't development taking place, it increases in brain capacity. But in the later period of human development, the physical development of the brain became less important than the development of human culture. And that's why the graph, if you like, if you do a continuous graph, tails off like that rather than going straight up like that. So again, to quote a modern scientist, which could very well have been taken directly from Engels, this is Stephen Oppenheimer, and he's a world-renowned expert on DNA studies. Rapidly increasing brain size was a key feature that set humans apart from the walking apes. Since then, our brains have trebled in volume. This increase was not gradual and steady. Most of it came as a doubling of volume in Homo erectus 2 million years ago. In other words, the greatest acceleration of relative brain size occurred before 1.5 million years ago. Now, what are the factors that gave that sudden spurt? What are the factors? Once there was an upright stance, once there was the ability to use hands, once, if you like, the interaction with nature began to develop greater neural capacity. What were the things that actually led to sudden spurts? What helped to drive that evolution forward? Well, again, if you look at Engels, he says, this is a quote from his essay, "The meat diet led to two new advances of decisive importance, the harnessing of fire and the domestication of animals. The first still further shortened the digestive process as it provided the mouth of food already, as it were, half digested." So Engels is suggesting that the development of a meat diet led to a shortening of the digestive tract, which would have been an evolutionary advantage because it means that your body uses less energy and protein, creating unnecessary digestive elements. And you're taking in particularly meat protein, which leads to a more rapid development of the animal. This is what Engels was suggesting 140 years ago. And he also talked about the harnessing of fire. His suggestion about the domestication of animals is probably premature. But nevertheless, the two other things are actually directly in line there with what modern archaeologists believe. Again, to quote somebody from the Department of Biological Anthropology in Cambridge, Professor Robert Foley, "Meat eating may be proposed as a significant part of the change in hominid energetics. Meat is a high quality resource, providing both ample energy and protein. There is certainly evidence for Homo ergaster of an increase in hominid involvement in animal butchery. Less gut tissue is required with higher levels of carnivory. So again, you could see this could almost be taken directly out of Engels. And a very interesting book published recently by Professor Richard Wrangham actually talks specifically about diet and fire. And he's put forward the idea that these particular leaps were specifically related to the development of a meat diet in this period and the development of fire and the development of, and now the most recent evidence pushes back human use of fire, of controlled fire that is, it's put it back further and further. So that particular stages, important stages in human development were associated with those things in exactly the same way that Engels predicted. Now, Engels wasn't right on every single point. He has some kind of quirky little ideas in his essay, which I won't go into, one or two which he seems to have picked up straight from Charles Darwin. But nevertheless, in the main line of what he was arguing, Engels was absolutely correct. Now, all the modern basis of archaeology and anthropology supports what Engels put forward at that particular time. And the significance of it isn't in simply saying, "Oh, wasn't Engels a clever man?" Because I say he made mistakes. But the importance of it lies in the fact that he was able to use the method of Marxism, the method of dialectical materialism, and he was able to apply it to the stage of knowledge at that particular time. And if you like, reinterpret it, remould it in a way that was actually more correct than was understood by other scientists at the time. And the main thrust of what Engels put forward at that time has been vindicated by the developments of science over the course of the last 140 years. Now, when I've been involved in discussions like this in the past, comrades have often said, well, where will human evolution take us now? Well, of course, we can make jokes about developing thumbs for texting and things like that, but they are jokes because as far as we can see, physical human evolution has virtually come to an end. But what we have now, and this is really the significant thing, is that whereas in the past cultural evolution was a dominant factor, now you could say really it is overwhelmingly the factor in human evolution. It's not likely, I can't see any physical reasons or possibility for human beings to evolve physically. I can't see anything that's going to drive that over the course of the next 100, 200 or 1,000 years. I can't see that happening. But without a shadow of doubt, cultural evolution is really the important stage of human development at that particular at this particular time. From the early days with the development of language, with the development of communication, with the development of a social kind of knowledge and a social and a cultural reservoir of skill, knowledge and ability and so on, from those early days. We now have a situation where human beings have got the capacity to put other human beings on the moon, to put other human beings on other planets, to provide the wherewithal to provide the necessities of life for the billions of people who populated the planet. That's the kind of evolution that we can actually see. But the most important step that has to be taken, really the most significant step in the whole of human evolution, is that step that is yet to be taken. That is the development of a society that's based upon planned, organized use of resources, planned, organized use of skills, of abilities, of technology, and so on. And that really would be the culmination the first stage of human society. And that's really why we are here this weekend, because we are trying to build precisely that kind of organization which can facilitate, which can act as the midwife, as it were, which can act as the driver for that very, very important stage in the evolution of human culture.